from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. I'm Ian Martinez. Thanks for staying with us on this Tuesday afternoon. Coming up, the city of Los Angeles has a new plan to make some streets a lot cooler. Well, in temperature, that is. Plus, the U.S. Census is looking to hire 500,000 people, about 37,000 of which here in Southern California. We'll talk all about that coming up. But we start with a retirement. Timothy White, the chancellor of the California State University system, announced this morning that he would step down at the end of June. White's been in the position since 2012 and has seen student enrollment and state funding increase over the years. During his tenure, he pushed for reforms that have won him praise, like boosting graduation rates, and others that he has been criticized for. Here to discuss it all, we have Adolfo Guzman Lopez, KPCC reporter covering higher ed. Hello, Adolfo.
Hello.
All right. This announcement comes not too long after UC President Janet Napolitano announced her retirement. So wondering, was this a surprise at all?
Well, I've been to the Cal State Trustees meetings the last several months, and I didn't hear anything. There was no inkling, no suggestion from Tim White that he was going to announce that he was going to retire. It was a surprise to some. I talked to leaders of the faculty union. They told me that this caught them off guard. Tim White's 70 years old. He's an accomplished professor, and he's been at the helm of, this is the largest public university system, not only in the state and the nation. He's been the chancellor for 7 years now.
Wow, so the UC and the CSU both are going to be kind of leaderless for a little bit. So why now? Why now for Timothy White?
Well, Tim White says that Cal State is stable, and unlike when he took over right around 2012 and in the years previous, if you remember, there was a lot of upheaval in the Cal State system. The recession forced the state to cut funding for the Cal State, and the trustees increased tuition. Tim White says that in the last 7 years, Cal State has increased enrollment by more than 40,000 students. There are good relations with Sacramento. And this is really important because it's the lawmakers who decide how much funding Cal State gets. And Tim White also says that the system office, which is based here in Long Beach, it has strong vice chancellors, and there are strong leaders in the Cal State campuses.
The best time to change over the leadership of the organization in my office is when the university is working well, rather than waiting until things start to wobble and they have to make a variety of changes all at once.
All right, now let's talk about some of his accomplishments. I listed a few earlier, but what's the most significant move he made while he was in charge? The one that maybe might have the most positive and lasting effect on the Cal State system?
Well, he's not saying it, but I think having covered the Cal State system for a while, it seems like this initiative, a graduation initiative, 2025, which he created, seems to be the one that may have the most far-reaching changes. He created a central office to push campuses to add more classes, overhaul the class offerings, create more student support programs such as tutoring, and then add technology to track the students to see that they're doing well. And when they're not doing well, a warning comes up to the professor and, you know, activate some tutoring. And some of the recent data shows that this graduation initiative is working. Tim White told me that improving the student experience is what drove this and other policy proposals.
Whether it's from the graduation initiative to food and housing issues to executive orders to changing leadership to have over half our presidents are women, all of that is around creating a better learning environment for our students to achieve and succeed and move on in life.
And it's worth noting that Tim White's reform approach had the backing of former Governor Jerry Brown, and that was very important because Brown allocated funding and then tied some of these reforms to that funding.
And it wasn't completely all about academics. Services improved on campuses, especially for some of the neediest students.
That's right. Now there are food pantries on campuses. There's an increased attention to food insecurity, homeless students, yeah, housing insecurity. Campuses are giving hotel vouchers for the neediest students, helping with emergency aid and helping students find help outside of campus. Tim White says that more attention to student mental health has been given. But here, the faculty union disagrees. They're saying that there are more part-time therapists, and that's not in the best interest of the students.
Now, one more thing, though. Not everything he did was liked. I'm thinking about one decision that ruffled my alma mater, Cal State Northridge, to make course requirements uniform across campuses. So tell us about that and maybe some other unpopular decisions.
Well, the faculty were up in arms at the way in which Tim White went about some of these changes. At Cal State Northridge, what happened is that Tim White overhauled the general education requirements, and then the faculty said, well, this is going to lead to fewer students taking ethnic studies classes, and that's bad for graduates, especially given, you know, the changing spectrum of society in the United States. The other change that Tim White carried out through an executive order was to eliminate the remedial classes, and professors had just months really to come up with a replacement. Yeah. That was really, faculty members said that they had a tough time with those changes.
That's KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez talking about CSU Chancellor Timothy White, who announced his retirement this morning. Adolfo, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, moving on. The U.S. Census wants to hire 500,000 temporary workers to conduct the 2020 census. About 37,000 of those folks will be in Southern California, which is notoriously difficult to count accurately. Thing is, though, a lot is at stake. For every person who is not counted, the state loses about $1,000 in federal funding for pretty important stuff like healthcare, social services, infrastructure. Here to find out more, we have Dale Kelly. She's Field Division Chief for the U.S. Census. And earlier today, she explained why it's so hard to get people to participate in this crucial population count.
The reason that people don't necessarily respond because they don't understand the importance of the information that they give, it determines the distribution of public funding. And people don't always necessarily understand that their community may miss out on that funding if they don't respond.
And in Southern California, one of the areas where there is concern about the lack of responses is in the Inland Empire, which is why the Census Bureau plans to dispatch more of its people out there to just knock on doors.
We certainly want to give people the opportunity to send their responses in and reply to the census in the comfort of their own homes by either going to the internet, by calling one of our call-in numbers, or mailing back the paper form once it's received. But in locations where sometimes that is a challenge, then we need census takers to actually go out and knock on doors and get that information from the household.
When it comes to your temporary census workers, what qualifications do they have to have? What skills do they need?
So it's really about what the requirements are, because we're going to train everybody that we hire. And they can find all of the requirements at our 2020 census website. But in terms of the skill set, of course, we're going to need that person who's going to be persistent. You know, we're going to have folks who aren't going to open their doors, or you know, they may have to return, but getting that accurate information and getting that census count, it's what's important. And also people who understand the importance of a census.
You mentioned, Dale, how you want people that understand the importance of the census. When they're out in the community, when they're out trying to get that accurate count, at that point, do these workers also relay the importance of the census to the people they're trying to count?
Yes, they do. They will have information as handouts to explain the importance, and then they will be knowledgeable, because that's something that we discuss and train them on, why we need that household to be counted in the census.
We're talking to Dale Kelly. She's Field Division Chief of the U.S. Census. Now, Southern California, as I'm sure you know, Dale, is an enormous melting pot of cultures that speak a multitude of languages. How does that factor into your thinking and your hiring?
We're certainly looking for folks who are bilingual in English and another language. That's why it's so important that we hire people to work in the communities in which they live. They're going to know their neighbors, and their neighbors are going to be familiar with them. So it's very important that we hire people who can communicate with the diverse culture of Southern California.
Now, one thing for the L.A. area, too, Dale, is that there's multiple families that live in apartments. How do you train census workers to get an accurate count with several people in one dwelling?
This is part of what we call our group quarters training. We're sending out notifications to the apartment buildings and managers in that apartment building. We're certainly knocking on their doors, and we're asking people to make sure that they include everyone in that household in the census. Make sure that they're including their children. Make sure they may include that cousin that has been living with them for a while. And we're going to be going door to door in those apartment buildings for households who don't respond to collect that information.
I remember the 2010 census missed more than 100,000 Latino children. How is that avoided this time around?
So we're gearing up our advertising and marketing efforts. We're doing a lot of work with schools. We're partnering with over 70,000 organizations, including Boys and Girls Clubs. We're doing events to just get the word out and help children understand the importance of the census. And we're giving children material to take home to their parents to make sure that their parents count them in the census.
All right. So once you get these temporary workers hired, when will they start conducting the 2020 census?
So we're going to start sending out notifications around mid-March and asking for responses. If we don't get those responses by mid-April, then our census takers are going to go out and start knocking on doors.
Dale, considering what is at stake here, how much pressure do you feel as field division chief for the U.S. Census?
You know, there's the pressure to make sure that we are counting this entire country. This is a massive effort, but that's why we're hiring 500,000 people to help us get it done.
Dale Kelly is field division chief for the U.S. Census. Dale, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. In an effort to make some of the hottest parts of the city cooler, Mayor Eric Garcetti unveiled the new Cool Streets LA program this afternoon. It's the city's latest effort to combat climate change by lowering street temperatures using a holistic approach. City Forest Officer Rachel Malarich was with us with the mayor for the announcement. She's with us now. Rachel, welcome to Take 2.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, today's announcement was made right at the intersection of West 54th Street and 5th Avenue in South LA. It's the first of 10 areas slated to undergo the Cool Street transformation. What strategies, Rachel, are being used to reduce temperatures?
So this specific project out of the 10 pilots used new street trees, cool pavement, added shade structures to bus benches, and did some outreach to the local business owners on how they could be participating as well.
Well, how can they participate? How can business owners take part?
So we have a number of energy efficiency rebate programs that are available through Los Angeles Department of Water and Power.
Okay, now the smaller streets have gotten cool pavements or cool roofs, but the approach now includes bus benches with shade coverings, hydration stations, and also trees, which definitely is a lot more holistic. How do all of those things work together for this overall cooling strategy?
Well, obviously, this is a project where we're starting to look at how we can combat climate change at the neighborhood level. And like you said, we're looking at a holistic approach to have all these different elements combined to lower the ambient temperatures and also make it more comfortable for Angelenos that are using public transit or walking through our communities.
Rachel, why do you think people don't think of trees as often when it comes to bringing temperatures down? I got this big, giant oak tree in my yard, and I swear that thing, just being there, allows me to not run my air conditioning as much. It just feels cool and nice if I open the window. I mean, trees are a great way to really make the city cooler.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir on that one. Honestly, you've had a personal experience with a tree that you've been able to live with and enjoy those benefits. Yeah. And not all of these communities have had that opportunity.
Is it just because sometimes when it comes to urban areas, we don't tend to green them up as much and don't put as many trees there as maybe we should?
I'm not sure if I would categorize it that way, but we definitely have in our built environment limited space for trees. And so some communities haven't had that prioritized. And now we're looking at not just identifying that need, which has been identified for some time, but we're really being aggressive about setting targets for increasing canopy cover in these areas.
When it comes to, a street, Rachel, that is tree-lined, where there's plenty of trees, plenty of shade like that, how much of a difference does that make in cooling down these kind of areas?
I mean, you can have as much of a 10 degree difference under the tree and out on the sidewalk. I was just walking the street right now, and it's so much more pleasant under the shade of a tree, not just because it's providing that protection from the sun, but also these are living things that are transpiring and providing cooling through that mechanism as well.
Okay, so what types of goals does the city have when it comes to implementing trees to these cooling strategies? And I'll note that there are not a lot of trees at the West 54th Street location there.
Well, there's more now.
Okay,
to this
yes.
And honestly, we're looking at two main goals, well, three. One is planting the additional 90,000 trees by the end of 2021, which is just the beginning. We're not saying 90,000 and we're done, but that's the initial project. And then increasing canopy by 50% in our areas of highest need and lowest canopy cover by 2028. So we're looking at communities like this one in South LA and others that we're working to identify to provide additional insight into how we can increase the canopy in those public spaces. The last of goals I'll just touch on right now is the development of an urban forestry management plan. And so that's looking at how are we going to manage the trees as a city with a common vision and goal for that urban forest to provide the maximum benefit to all Angelenos.
You know, Rachel, I just got a tweet from someone who asked what particular kind of trees work better for this. So I'm wondering, is there a specific kind of tree or maybe a group of trees that work better for this kind of system?
So this is a question I've been getting most often, and I will give you the same answer I've given everyone else. I need to see the location.
Well,
I don't have time to come out and look at your property, unfortunately. I wish I could. But you need to look at your space. How much room do you have in that parkway space in front of your home? How much room is there between your fence and your home itself? What are your goals with that tree? Can you plant it on the south, east, or west sides to really maximize those energy efficiency benefits? That is the reason that DWP funds the free tree program that all Angelenos can access and get 7 free trees delivered to their home. Within that, you should be thinking about it. What is the right tree for your space? And my charge is we should be putting in the biggest tree that is appropriate. I'm not saying put in the biggest tree. I'm saying think about your space. Look at the growth space available for that tree, both in the ground and then above it. Are there power lines and other wires? And then putting in the tree that will fit the space that you have and provide those benefits. And within that, also pick something that you find attractive. Yeah. That's really important as well.
It makes sense, though, Rachel, because I would have chosen any tree, but I got to remember that the tree that fits the space is the one that will work the best. Rachel Malerich is city forest officer. She joined us to talk about the city's efforts to reduce temperatures in urban areas. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, moving on. National cemeteries are out of real estate in big cities around the country. In many areas, there's not enough land to offer below-ground burials to veterans and their spouses. The solution? Well, the VA is building more high-density memorial structures above ground to give vets the option to stay closer to home. KPCC's Libby Denkman has more.
Army Air Corps vet Leon Waldman points out fresh landscaping and swaying palm trees alongside the 405 freeway near Westwood.
This is nice. We're all outdoors.
The former World War II B-17 waste gunner is scoping out his final resting place, the newly expanded Columbarium on the West LA VA campus. It's a series of thick concrete walls with niches to store cremated remains. The first phase of the project has room for more than 10,000 vets and their spouses. It's a day Waldman's been waiting for. He arranged for his cremation over 10 years ago.
You know, I got the empty urn sitting at home waiting to go in one of these niches.
When it's time, Waldman wants to stay in the city where his son lives and make things convenient for family visiting from New York. But a burial was out of the question because LA's National Cemetery hit capacity in 1978. It hasn't taken new applications for over 4 decades. The closest plots available are hours away in Riverside or Bakersfield. The cemetery's original indoor columbarium, which holds 5,000 remains, also filled up that year.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
VA Secretary Robert Wilkie presided over the new columbarium dedication.
After 40 years, we now welcome a new generation of Americans to take their place among the honored here at this hallowed ground.
He acknowledged his agency's National Cemetery Administration is facing a real estate crunch in large cities where most veterans live.
Because space is running out.
A solution is in the works, but it's running behind schedule and over budget. In 2015, the VA announced a series of projects to expand National Cemetery capacity in L.A., New York, Indianapolis, Chicago, and San Francisco. Los Angeles's Columbarium is the first completed project under the Urban Initiative.
We did not want to have to force families to travel all over the state to visit their family members.
The VA now estimates the San Francisco Cemetery project, first slated for completion in 2017, won't open until at least 2027. And the VA is on its fifth attempt at buying land in Chicago. Four previous tries went bust, mostly because the asking price went over budget.
And in places like this, everybody is short of land.
Even Arlington National Cemetery is facing a shortage of burial sites. This month, the Army announced it's considering tightening the rules for who has access to below-ground interment. Only troops killed in action, Purple Heart recipients, former POWs, and those who earned a Silver Star or higher would be allowed in. Los Angeles National Cemetery Director Tom Ruck says it was emotional to finally begin accepting applications on October 1st.
It's fantastic, and I'm starting to tear up a little bit because I know what it means to the veterans and their family members.
Ruck is expecting a bit of a rush after years of no vacancies at this veteran cemetery. Many Angelenos have been holding on to family members' remains in urns at home.
I can tell you that there's a whole lot of people that have mom or dad or their uncle or their brother up in the closet just waiting for this to happen.
I got a nice place to come to, yeah. Can afford Westwood, so this is the way I'll make it.
Secretary Wilkie says the agency is doing its best to get cemetery construction on track, and it's offering to take over old military property and convert it into columbariums and grave sites. In the meantime, veterans' families who want a casket burial will still have to drive to surrounding cities for the nearest available National Cemetery plots. I'm Libby Denkman.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. We turn now to deforestation, which is happening all along the California coast, including underwater. A recent study from the UC Davis Coastal Marine Sciences Institute and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife found that kelp ecosystems are deforesting at an alarming rate, endangering much of the sea life it supports. Dr. Laura Rogers-Bennett works with both organizations as a researcher and joins us to discuss her team's findings. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right. I think a lot of Californians are going to be bracing themselves for some bad news. Tell us what's happening to the kelp ecosystem right now.
Yes. Well, right now in Northern California, north of San Francisco, we've seen the impacts of the massive marine heat wave that we had back in 2015, 2016, and those impacts are playing out with a 90% decline in the bull kelp forest, which has had impacts to our abalone and sea urchin populations.
Wow, that's definitely tough to hear. I know the study explains that this deforestation over the last two decades is climate-driven. How is it climate-driven, Doctor?
As climate warms, we're going to be experiencing more intense heat waves. They're going to be longer in duration, and they're going to be more frequent. And that's going to be the case on land as well as in the water. And so what we're seeing is a marine heat wave that has impacted our coast and was generated by a warm water blob that sat up in Alaska, the Gulf of Alaska, and reached all the way down into our Northern California waters.
Now, Doctor, you mentioned the abalone that is suffering, but the kelp forest supports all kinds of sea life. And the study lays out a timeline and the effects on the critters in the sea. And I understand that sea stars were the first to become affected. They experienced a wasting disease. What happened after the sea stars started to waste away?
Following that, we had the marine heat wave, and then the heat continued with a strong El Nino. All those multiple stressors really combined when the purple sea urchin population really exploded in our region. And now we have close to 30 times more purple urchin than we've ever seen in the system.
If the sea stars were there, they would help take care of those urchin, right?
They would, yes. But with this huge decline in the kelp associated with the warm water, there's not enough nitrogen for that kelp to grow. And so that really knocked back our kelp. And then the urchin have been keeping that kelp down, even though our water temperatures have returned to the cooler normal condition.
So aside then from being a food source, how else does the kelp forest help the shoreline?
Sure. Well, the kelp forest does lots of services for us. It is the home and food source for many of our marine creatures. There is carbon sequestration happening. They suck up a lot of carbon for us. They are harvested themselves, and we use alginates from kelp. So the kelp forest is much like a coral reef. It's the main structuring foundation species for the whole nearshore rocky ecosystem.
We're talking about California's suffering kelp forest with Dr. Laura Rogers Bennett. She works with UC Davis Coastal Marine Sciences Institute and also the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now, all this, Doctor, everything you just mentioned, how does this impact the local economy? Because a lot of businesses rely on a healthy ecosystem that might not be as healthy anymore.
Absolutely. This has had devastating consequences for our local coastal economy here in Northern California. Particularly hard hit have been the counties of Marin, Sonoma, Mendocino. The recreational red abalone fishermen, that fishery brings in about $44 million a year, and that is now no longer happening. Also, commercial red sea urchin divers used to harvest delicious seafood product in the kelp forest, they're no longer able to sell their product because the urchin are almost empty inside. So they have filed for federal disaster relief.
Now, your research suggests urchin farming as a possible solution. How would that work?
So the idea is that we would bring in these empty purple urchin into grow-out facilities, ranching facilities, feed them an artificial kelp-based diet that can fatten up the urchin. And then once those urchins regrow their roe, then they would be a tasty restorative seafood product that we could sell that could help generate funds for removing urchin that are overpopulating many areas in the North Coast and give that kelp a break from that feeding urchins so that they can regrow.
That's Dr. Laura Rogers Bennett, senior environmental scientist from UC Davis and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, telling us about the state of the kelp forests on California's coast. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, you may have felt it in the air. It is spooky season. That's right, Halloween, a little over a week away. So we want to know, do you have an eerie L.A. story like this one?
All of a sudden, I hear this sound. It sounded like children or a high pitch, some cackling. And I go into the living room. I look over and I see transparent ghosts. These apparitions, you could see right through them, and they were just kind of floating. J.L., get out of here, get out. And all of a sudden, they just took off up the stairway, up to the second floor loft, leaving behind, I'll never forget, it was the smell of a burnt match.
But hey, not all ghostly encounters are ghastly. There's also some heartwarming tales we've received in the past, like this one about Joe.
One night, I saw what looked to be a man in army fatigues swaying in front of the stage. When I got closer to see who he was, He seemed to be translucent. I tried to reach out to him, and he disappeared right in front of me. I saw Joe several times at the club. His image never frightened me. He actually made me smile.
Do you have a tale that's scary, creepy, eerie, or maybe kind of nice? We would love to hear it. Go to our Facebook. We're at Take Two Show. Click on the Halloween call out to submit your story so we can feature it on our show next week.